This is the second day of this November 2014 7-day Sesshin. And that will resume reading of the early masters in Zen from a book called Zen Dawn, translated by J.C. Cleary. These are the earliest Zen texts rediscovered at last century in the Dunhuang Caves in northwestern China. We're still reading the first of these early masters. This is Gunabhadra. He was speaking about pacifying mind. The last thing he said was, if you do not irrigate the karmic field with the water of desire, if you do not plant the seeds of consciousness there, this is called Dharma practice. About desire, this is a very common way of understanding the Buddhist teaching that desire and aversion, its backside, the flip side of desire is aversion. Cause suffering. And then a common rejoinder is, well, what about the desire for enlightenment? Isn't that desire? And yes it is. It's desire. It's the one desire, it would seem, the one desire that burns up all other desires, this aspiration to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings. And yet even this, if it is clung to in the mind as a goal, is an obstruction. That's the whole point of these particular practices we work on in Zen, the breath and the koan and shikantaza, is to not attach to that even enlightenment as a goal in the mind. We have to get rid of all goals. We have to empty the mind of all thought forms of any kind in order to awaken to this true nature. Now Gunabhadra continues, just now I spoke of pacifying mind. In brief, there are four kinds of mentality. First, the mentality that turns away from truth. This is the mentality of those who go through life as ordinary people. So turning away from truth means willingly dwelling in one's thoughts. And this is the mind of the ordinary person. Most all human beings is to live in thoughts. Second, the mentality that turns toward truth. This means loathing birth and death, and so seeking nirvana and going towards stillness. It is called the Shravaka mentality. Little sidebar here. The Shravaka is the first of the four enlightened states of existence. We often talk about the six unenlightened states of existence: hell, hungry ghosts, animals, asuras, humans, and devas. And then the next four are the different levels of enlightenment, beginning with the Shravaka. Loathing birth and death, and so seeking nirvana, going to a stillness. To loathe birth and death is something that I think we have to have undergone our share of suffering to really be able to understand that, to not want to be reborn into this world of samsara and its suffering. Third, the mind that enters truth. Though you cut off barriers to the path and reveal inner truth, subject and object are not yet nullified. This is the bodhisattva mentality. So this is, here, you know, a lot of these terms can be understood in different ways. Here, seeing bodhisattva as still not at the level of a full Buddha, a fully enlightened one. And when he says subject and object are not yet nullified, this suggests that the faint lingering attachment of a bodhisattva is to still want to help others. This is what distinguishes a bodhisattva from a full Buddha, is bodhisattvas, though they may be enlightened, still have this agenda of wanting to help others before entering nirvana. That is, they renounce their full Buddhahood in order to help others. You know, as far as attachments go, this is a good one to have. It's one of the better ones. But still, from the point of view of ultimate purity, there still is this notion of an other out there, others who I, the subject, have to help. It's a very advanced state, but still not the ultimate state of seeing beyond self and other. Buddhas, full Buddhas, are those who help others completely unselfconsciously. They do it as naturally and effortlessly as breathing. And that's the fourth, the mind of truth. So the first of the four is the mentality that turns away from truth. This is more than 99% of humanity. And then the mentality that turns toward truth, this is rare enough. And then the mind that enters truth, functioning through enlightened awareness. And then the fourth is the mind of truth. And he says, not mind outside truth, not truth outside mind. Truth is mind. Or if truth is, can be kind of an abstract word, a little bit less abstract word, is the way or the Tao. The way is mind. Mind is the way. This very mind is Buddha. He says, mind is able to be everywhere equal, so it is called truth. Truth's awareness can illuminate everything, so it is called mind. Mind and truth are everywhere equal, so it is called Buddha mind, the mind of enlightenment. Now we're getting into territory that has spawned many koans. What is Buddha? It became kind of a formula for what is the ultimate truth. This very mind is Buddha. And then another koan, what is Buddha? The master replied, not mind, not Buddha. Whatever you think it is, can't be it as a thought. You Even to talk about mind and truth as two different things, even in a relationship of equality, okay, mind is truth, truth is mind, still, by using two different words, we're still suggesting two-ness. Another way of saying it, perhaps better, is it's just this. This is it. Ah, there it is again. This and it, two different words. It's the great, great distinction of Zen. Is recognition that it cannot be encompassed in words. Anytime we use words, we're missing it. But nonetheless, words are used to point to this reality, this mind, this truth, this way that is beyond words. He continues, those who understand reality do not see any difference between birth and death and nirvana, or ordinary and holy. Objects and knowledge are not two. Inner truth and phenomena are fused. Real and conventional are viewed as equal. Defilement and purity are one suchness. Buddhas and sentient beings always refers to the so-called unenlightened. So, just to translate here, the enlightened and the unenlightened are fundamentally equal and at one. The Lankavatara Sutra says, there is no nirvana in anything. No nirvana Buddha, no Buddha nirvana. It is detached from awakening and that which is awakened too. Detached from both being and nothingness. In other words, it's beyond this mind, capital M, mind, this Tao, is beyond distinctions such as awakening or non-awakening. He says the great path is fundamentally omnipresent, perfectly pure, and basically existent. It is not attained from causes. It's not attained from causes. It's not a matter of cause and effect. Doesn't have anything to do with it. It's more fundamental than that. He says, it is like the sun hidden behind floating clouds. When the clouds are gone, the sun appears by itself. What's the use of any more learning or views? Why become involved in written or spoken words and come back again to the path of birth and death? Those who take verbal explanations and literary accounts as the path, the way, covet fame and profit. They ruin themselves and ruin others. It is like polishing a mirror. When the dust on the surface has been totally removed, the mirror of itself is bright and clear. This statement, those who take verbal explanations and literary accounts as the way, covet fame and profit, they ruin themselves and ruin others. So if they see only the realm of explanations and stories and words and concepts, then they're apt to misuse those things and cause problems. All things are uncompounded. The sutra says, I guess this is still the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha is not Buddha, nor does he save sentient beings. Sentient beings impose distinctions and think that Buddha saves sentient beings. Thus they do not realize this mind, and they have no stability. So again, this dividing the indivisible. His warning of attachment to the idea that sentient beings have to be saved, liberated, when in fact we are all originally whole and completely enlightened. With realization, there is awareness and great function amid causal origination, penetrating perfectly without obstruction. This is called great cultivation of the path. There is no duality between self and other. All practices are carried out at once. There is no before or after, and no in between. It is called the great vehicle. This is seeing the eternal, the unborn, the unoriginated, that which is beyond arising and disappearing. And then he gets into the six, what are called the six paramitas, or the six perfections. These are the qualities that those of us on the path are developing, either whether we're consciously trying to do it or not. These are the fruits of earnest practice, these six. And these are dana, or giving, or charity, is the first. The second is sila, S-I-L-A, which is discipline or morality. The third is forbearance or patience, and then zeal or vigor, and then meditation, and then wisdom. And then he goes through and talks about each of these six in terms of their transcendent quality. So, having no attachments within or without, the great ultimate relinquishment. This is called dana paramita, the perfection of giving. So in each of these six, we can distinguish between the ordinary sense of the word, in this case giving, being generous, giving to charity, and then the perfection of giving, which is doing so with the realization that there is no self or other. And therefore, ultimately, no giving. That's the perfection of giving. The second one, good and evil equal, so neither can be found. This is sila paramita, the perfection of morality. Third, to have no transgressions amid the objects of mind, the harm of rancor forever ended. This is Kshanti paramita, the perfection of patience. Patience, I think maybe a better word is forbearance, which means patience in the face of mistreatment, let's say. And then the fourth, great stillness, unmoving, the myriad activities spontaneously so. This is virya paramita, the perfection of energetic progress or effort. The flourishing of wondrous stillness. This is dhyana paramita, the perfection of meditation. And then wondrous stillness, opening forth illumination. This is prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom. People who are like this are lofty and vast, taking in everything perfectly without obstruction, achieving rich and varied functioning. This is the great vehicle, the Mahayana. Let's just pick one of these, the fourth effort. This is a question that we're all working with in our zazen, maybe forever, which is how to realize this perfection of effort, which is beyond ordinary striving. It's a question that comes up to me in Doksan every sesshin, sometimes more than once, where people lay out the dilemma. If I'm working to get something and pushing myself, then I get tight. It doesn't seem to be a very effective way of working. But I have to make an effort, right? How do I do this? How do I really apply myself and make a strong effort without getting kind of tied up in tension? I don't think anyone can spell this out for you. It's like so many other things in Zen practice, it's something you just have to grow into through the effort. The effort itself is what can lead us to this purifying of one's effort. So it's not based on grasping, but it becomes an effortless effort. That's the paramita, the perfection of effort. But it happens on its own. It emerges. The more we can refrain from clinging to ideas, goals. This is like so many things in practice. It's just a matter, it brings us back to just faith. Faith that if we trust the process, if we just keep returning to our practice without trying to figure this out, that we'll find our way there. So we practice imperfectly. We find ourselves over and over again getting too tense. Or usually it becomes a kind of an oscillating between becoming too tense and then becoming too lax. We find that becoming too tense doesn't work, and so then we back off and we go too far and become too passive. And then this pendulum swings back, and eventually, this swinging pendulum comes closer and closer to this balance point in the center. Just trust the process. It'll sort itself out. If you're making a sincere effort, it will sort itself out. Maybe not today, maybe not this session, but it will. Our effort becomes more refined, becomes less a matter of self. And that's where surrender is part of this process. Learning to surrender to the practice while still making the effort. He quotes the Huayan Sutra, "If you have no views, then you can see." This is a nice little guiding principle. If you have no views, if you have no notions in the mind, no concepts, no ideas, then you can see what is beyond all concepts. The Si Yi Sutra says, "It is not something seen with the eyes or known by the senses. It must be seen by according with thusness. All the senses are thus, and so is the thusness of the Dharma. Seeing like this is called correct seeing." Because of their inverted perceptions, because of their karmic barriers, ordinary people do not see reality. This being so, light is not definitely light, and darkness is not definitely darkness. If you understand like this and you are not confused by inverted thinking, then you will enter into the eternity, the bliss, the personality, and the purity of the Tathagatas, the enlightened ones. These four, the eternity, the bliss, the personality, and the purity, is another translation for what we do in the Kanongyo that we chant. Eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. These are said to be the qualities of enlightenment, eternity, joy. Personality here, what he translates as personality really means no self and purity. This statement is typically paradoxical for Zen texts. Light is not definitely light, and darkness is not definitely darkness. In our chant, the harmony of relative and absolute, we say, "Within light there is darkness, but do not try to understand that darkness. Within darkness there is light, but do not try to find that light." Why not? Why not try to understand that darkness? Because it's nothing we can see. It's the nature of searching is that it cannot be seen. The great teacher Guna Bahadra said, "The Lankavatara Sutra says, how can one purify one's thoughts? Do not allow false thinking. Do not allow defiled thinking. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of Buddha." mindfulness of Buddha here means no mind. One expression of this no mind is the breath. Another is mu. Any time we're questioning, any fundamental question leads us into this realm of no mind. The unborn, that's Buddha. Put your utmost energy into mindfulness of Buddha, or mu. Let mindfulness of Buddha continue without a break. You will be still, without thoughts, and you will witness the fundamental empty purity. Guna Bahadra also said, once this is received, you do not fall back from eternal stillness. Thus Buddha said, how can it be increased? How can it be increased? How can we possibly increase what is illimitable? This mind. Nothing lacking, nothing in excess. Such is our nature. It's not in the realm of increasing or growing, nor in decreasing or shrinking. It just is. Mu. He also said, you learn from the teacher, but enlightenment does not come from the teacher. Whoever would, quote, make people wise has never expounded the Dharma. It is verified in the event. So how can you make someone wise? How can you enlighten someone who's always been enlightened? From the no beginning time. He also said, the leaves of a tree can teach the Dharma, a jar can teach the Dharma, a pillar can teach the Dharma, a staff can teach the Dharma, a room can teach the Dharma. Earth, water, fire, and air can all teach the Dharma. Earth, wood, tile, and stone can also teach the Dharma. What is this? There's a saying in Zen, everything is Buddha. Everything is teaching. Everything. The cushion we're sitting on. Every sound. A cough in the room. Clearing of the throat. And the absence of all sounds. Silence is Buddha teaching the Dharma. Pain is Buddha. Tiredness is Buddha. And now we turn to section 2 of this volume, which is Tripitaka Dharma Teacher Bodhidharma. It outlines, it begins by outlining the basics in broad strokes of Bodhidharma's life. He traveled by sea to the southeast coast of China and went from there to the capital at the time. The monks Da Yu and Wei Ke served him for 5 years before he instructed them in the four practices. We'll get to that tomorrow, the four practices. He said to Weka, "There is the Lankavatara Sutra in four scrolls. If you practice according to it, you will naturally be liberated." Notice he doesn't say if you study it thoroughly. He says if you practice according to it, you will naturally be liberated. Here, some more of just the basics of Bodhidharma. Remember, this is all from yellowed ancient scrolls found in these grottos in the Gobi Desert. This is just the translation of the Chinese. The Dharma teacher Bodhidharma was a man of southern India, the third son of a local monarch. His intellect was very incisive and clear, and he clearly understood what he was taught. His will was set on the great vehicle, so he abandoned lay life and became a monk. He perpetuated the seed of the sages and made it flourish. With deepest mind empty and still, he saw through and comprehended the things and events of the world. Inner and outer, he was clear about it all. His virtue went beyond the world. His compassion and concern reached every corner of the land. The correct teaching was in decline, so he came from afar across mountains and seas, traveling to teach in the lands of China. Those who cultivated mind-emptied, still silence all believed in him. The type who cling to forms and fixate on opinions began to slander and denounce him. The legend is that rival monks tried repeatedly to poison Bodhidharma and finally did so. It's hard to know that. Historians have definitely confirmed the life of Bodhidharma, but as far as these kinds of details, we can't be sure of anything. This sentence, his will was set on the Mahayana, the great vehicle, so he abandoned lay life and became a monk. I'm reminded of this very incisive words of in Zen, when thoughts of the Dharma are strong, worldly thoughts are weak. When worldly thoughts are strong, thoughts of the Dharma are weak. There's a lot in that. We can't have it both ways. If we want to dwell in worldly thoughts, worldly is just about any thoughts, certainly any thoughts of self and other, of my, of any of the many diversions and pleasures and distractions of life, thoughts of movies and food and Facebook and just about anything we can conceive of. If those thoughts are strong, thoughts of the way, the Dharma, will be weak, and vice versa. Try it. Experiment. See if you can do both. It's a big part of serious practice is how to choose how to spend your free time. There's so many options out there now, ways of amusing ourselves. I urged staff a few days ago, staff, since they have the freedom of more time than householders, more free time than householders, to use that time. The night before Sesshin, to do Zazen. How many of them did? I don't know. It really comes down to getting clear about what it is we want, what our aspiration is, and that will determine how we spend our time, to what we direct our attention. It continues, during this time, Bodhidharma only had the two monks, Da Yu and Wei Ke, with him. Though they were younger, they brought with them wills that were lofty and far-reaching. Being fortunate enough to meet with a Dharma teacher, they served him many years, respectfully seeking instruction. They learned well, encountering the teacher's intent. Moved by their fine energy and sincerity, the Dharma teacher instructed them in the true path. He taught them how to pacify mind, how to develop practice, how to accord with beings, and how to employ skill and means. This is the great vehicle teaching for pacifying mind. Let there be no error. Those who pacify mind like this do wall gazing. Those who develop practice like this do the four practices. Those who accord with beings like this prevent slander and dislike. Those who have skill and means like this dispense with what does not apply. And then he goes on to elaborate on these four practices. And we'll pick up there tomorrow, and now stop and recite the four vows.